But reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we ask you to hold your calls for the time being, because we have us on the line right now from back in Maryland, Pastor David Whitney. David, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Okay, well, it's good to have you with us. And Pastor Whitney is with the Institute on the Constitution. And although he is an ordained minister and he has his own church, he puts in a great deal of time trying to teach Americans about the Christian heritage of our country. And with that as a background, David, you pick up the story.
Well, in past shows, we've been discussing the Constitution itself, looking at the first article, which deals with the legislative branch, the second article dealing with the executive branch, and tonight we come to the third article, the judicial branch. And just a note, if you were to compare the size of these three articles, the third article, dealing with the judiciary, is by far the smallest. The executive branch is 2 to 3 times larger. The legislative branch, the number of words, is at least 4 times, maybe even 5 times larger, which indicates the importance granted there in the three branches. But they saw the legislature as extremely important, and the executive a little less, and the judicial even less important. In fact, some of our founders, I believe it was Alexander Hamilton, said that we had the least to fear from the judiciary, because the judiciary just was basically applying the law in specific cases, and it really had no great powers to make any changes in our form of government, or that would really lie with the executive branch, well, moreover, really lie with the legislative branch. So we had nothing to fear from a judiciary. And yet today, that's exactly the most tyrannical branch of our federal government, and in many cases our state governments as well, because they've caught on to the game being played, and they're playing it just as well. So what has happened is we have a judiciary that has broken out of the bounds designed by our founders to protect us from the tyranny of black-robed judges. They never wanted what we see in our day, where judges make law from the bench. You know, there's no way that a judge was supposed to make law. That was the job of the legislative branch, not the job of the judiciary. And yet people today commonly mistake things, and they think, you know, the judges make law. For example, many people think of Roe v. Wade, which is the opinion of the Supreme Court regarding one set of people, Roe and Wade, just the opinion that only governs and deals with those people in that specific set of circumstances. Yet most people today believe that, well, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, we're told. No, it's not, because the judicial branch, judges, do not make law. The legislative branch that makes law. And yet today, most people do not understand the role of the legislative branch and the executive branch and the judicial branch. And the result is that the judicial branch has been allowed, or actually I believe encouraged by the other two branches, to become tyrannical. And the reason being is they know the judicial branch is not directly accountable to we the people. It's only indirectly accountable through our elected representatives, to hold them accountable and to appoint them and to remove them from office if they violate their oath of office. So they know that there's a protection that those evildoers can have in breaking the law.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution, talking about the Constitution. Go right ahead, Pastor.
Well, looking back at the details, Article 3 is divided into three specific sections. The first section talks about judicial power, and judicial power vests, that is, it permanently resides in a Supreme Court and only in the lower federal courts as Congress determines. In other words, the only federal court that must exist is the Supreme Court. All the other lower federal courts, the Circuit Court and so on, all those courts are at the whim and call of Congress. Congress can create them. Congress can reconfigure them. Congress can abolish them. It can do whatever it wants with those lower federal courts because they do not have to constitutionally exist. The only federal court that has to constitutionally exist is the Supreme Court. And so, well, Congress has established federal district courts and circuit courts of appeals and so on all over the country, but Congress could abolish these, add additional levels, cut these districts up, whatever it wanted to do, if it chose to. And the point here being is that many people believe, and Congress is part of this lie going out, that when the federal court rules on something, not even the Supreme Court, when a federal court rules on an issue, well, that's the end of the story. We can't do anything except pass another piece of legislation to try to change it. I think of the example of the Pledge of Allegiance. The Ninth Circuit said, it's against the Constitution somehow to say under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and therefore the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional. A ridiculous idea if there ever was one. But it was interesting to see the reaction of congressmen and senators wringing their hands. What the awful thing, and we can't do anything about this except maybe we can pass a resolution, you know, saying that we believe under God should be in the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, such a wimpy, weak response when, in matter of fact, if they felt like they could entirely destroy the Ninth Circuit by absorbing it into another circuit or dividing it up into other circuits, they could do whatever they want to basically punish those judges for doing unconstitutional things in their decisions, because Congress basically is the policeman, you could say, for the federal judiciary, because judges do not hold office for life, which is one of the lies that has been spouted again and again so often that most people believe, once somebody becomes a federal judge, they're a judge for life. Not so. The Constitution says judges hold office during good behavior. Good behavior means fidelity to the Constitution as it was originally intended. Not making up their own idea of what the Constitution says, but what the Constitution actually says. Now, so
judges... Hold that thought right there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney, and we're simply pointing out that the courts do not make laws. They are to interpret the laws that have been passed by Congress. And any time Congress wanted to do away with the abortion issue, all they would do would be pass a law saying abortion may not be determined and the status of abortion may not be determined by the federal government. This is a state issue. And furthermore, the Supreme Court cannot have anything to do with this. We limit their appellate jurisdiction in this matter of abortion, and that would be the end of it. But you see, George Bush says that, he is pro-life, but he has never recommended this be done. The leaders of both the House of Representatives and the Senate are both Republicans, and they claim they're a pro-life, but they've never tried to solve the abortion problem. And you have to understand this is all part of the game they play to make you think that one party is pro-life, the other is pro-choice, one is pro-homosexual, the other is anti-homosexual. It's a game. They're playing games with our minds. And until you understand that the leaders of both political parties, want abortion, and that's why they're not doing anything about it, they're going to have all sorts of discussions and make all sorts of statements, but never judge the members of Congress by what they say. Watch what they do. And believe me, the Republicans have controlled both houses of the legislature and the presidency for over 5 years. They've never once approached Roe versus Wade. In fact, the only thing they did at one time is they were going to vote it into law. In fact, that was in one of the original Senate votes. They took that out in the conference committee. So, go right ahead, David.
So when Congress cries that, the federal judiciary, we can't do anything about their wicked and unconstitutional decisions, they're lying to the people. Either that or they're so ignorant of the Constitution. I, a mere layman who have studied the Constitution and am teaching it, but certainly they are disqualified from office if they do not know these provisions of the Constitution and they do not know their duty as congressmen and senators to hold the judges accountable. And so we the people, if we know the Constitution, we in turn can hold our legislative officials accountable and say, you need to be doing this instead of crying in your hands. You need to be removing these judges from office. You need to be rearranging those circuit courts or eliminating them or doing something to drastically punish a federal court that violates the law of the land. Because when anybody, whether a judge or not, violates the law of the land, he is a law breaker. And the punishment for breaking that law is to be removed from office. And the person or the people who are supposed to do that job, removing them from office, are Congress and the Senate. And they have failed to do it again and again. We've talked about impeachment before. And over the course of more than 200 years, there's only been four impeachments where the judges have actually been removed from the bench. You think there is such a purity among our judges that there's only four that deserve to be impeached? Oh, my goodness. There's so many that deserve to be impeached. There's been listed 1,000 or several thousand just in our own day that should be impeached. Congress is not doing their job. Why not? The American people don't know the Constitution, and therefore they don't know that they need to hold their legislative officials accountable to the standard and saying, you guys got to hold these judges accountable because we don't have any direct check on those judges. It's the legislative branch that's supposed to only allow those judges to hold office during good behavior. And so the next time there's something like that come up, call your congressman and say, you should be punishing these guys by impeaching them. You should be punishing them by perhaps disestablishing their federal court if it's a court completely out of control. And so while it's true, and there's many books out today decrying judicial tyranny, and it is true, we have a wicked system now where we're under the thumb of an oligarchy of black-robed lawyers. Most people don't have a high opinion of lawyers, but it seems that as soon as you put a black dress on a lawyer, everybody says, oh, you know, whatever he says is the final word on the law. No, it's not. The three branches of government are equal against one another. There's checks and balances between them, and to have what many people call for today, what they say, oh, we need an independent judiciary. What they're really saying is we need a judiciary that is not accountable to anybody, that basically rules as if they were God and their word is absolute law. We don't want that. No, our founders didn't want that. They experienced that with King George III. He appointed the judges. He paid their salaries. He told them what to do, and if they didn't do King George III's will, he removed them immediately and replaced them with someone who would do his will. They knew what it was to be under the tyranny of wicked black-robed judges, and they did not want that to happen in our day. It's interesting with Gouverneur Morris, who was actually the penman for the Constitution, actually sat down and took the words and put them in a very neat form for the first copy of the Constitution. Gouverneur Morris said, those who are charged with the important duties of administering justice should, if possible, depend only on God. Wow, that sounds like an amazing statement, particularly in our day where people think God and government have nothing to do with each other, and Mom, I need you to put a big wall of separation, which, by the way, is a lie. It's never in the Constitution, as you know. But I think of our current Supreme Court Justice, Roberts, when he was going through his confirmation hearings, he was asked something about, I guess it was about his religion or something to that effect. And he came out and said very boldly and very forcefully that the Bible would have nothing to do with the decisions he made from the bench. The Bible was irrelevant. Wow, that's the complete opposite view of our founders, who said that the Bible is, in the Declaration says, the laws of nature, and the laws of nature's God, that second phrase refers directly to the Bible. They said that the Bible is the supreme law of the universe. Therefore, any law made in violation of that law, God's law, laws of nature, nature's God, any law made in violation of that's null and void. It's nothing at all. It's a piece of paper with ink spilled on it that has no force whatsoever. It's not law. And yet we have the Supreme Court Justice of the United States today saying the opposite. He's saying, oh, well, the Bible has nothing to do with law. And that's because he is, as many of these other are, wicked black-robed lawyers who have shunned the original design of our Christian constitutional republic, and they have shunned the very meaning of the words of our Constitution, our Declaration, and our Bill of Rights. And therefore, they should be replaced. But we, the people, cannot do that directly. We have to appeal to our legislative branch and to the executive branch to do that job, which needs to be done in our day. The last item in Section 1 of Article 3 deals with compensation and just states that compensation of judges may not be diminished during their tenure. And, of course, this prevents congressional interference with their duties. Now, Section 2 of Article 3 is very important. And Dr. Stain, you've already mentioned this, that there are two areas of jurisdiction for the Supreme Court. The first is original jurisdiction, and that is a case that goes directly to the federal court system and may go up through the federal court system to the Supreme Court, but it doesn't start in a state court system. It starts in the federal court system. And these areas of jurisdiction involve foreign officials, that is, an ambassador or someone like that. So obviously, if there's a problem that has come about with an ambassador of another country, it would be inappropriate for one state, say the state of Massachusetts, to try to resolve that in their court system. It needs to be a representative of all the states. Therefore, that obviously makes sense that the federal judiciary handles that. Likewise, anything involving maritime law, since it would be very difficult for individual states to resolve something at sea, having different laws regarding that. But admiralty and maritime law are all original jurisdiction for the federal court system. And then, obviously, a controversy between two states. If the state of Virginia was in conflict with the state of Maine, which court system would hear that case? Obviously, whoever got the home court advantage would have a great advantage in that situation. And so to prevent that sort of thing, any conflicts between states would obviously go to the federal court system, as well as conflicts between citizens of foreign countries and individual states, or citizens of different states. Particularly if you were suing a state of which you were not a citizen, that would go to the federal court. Now, there was a change that took place, the very First Amendment after the Bill of Rights was ratified, and that First Amendment was the 11th Amendment in 1795, and this was a case in a contract made between a citizen of another state, Brailsford, and the state of Georgia. And basically, Georgia said, well, this guy can't sue us. After all, we're a state government, you know, we're sovereign. They can't touch us. And, you know, the court system, we went through the court system, and the ultimate result was an amendment was formed that said, yeah, that's true. You can't sue a state if you aren't a citizen of that state. Or, no, actually the term is you can't sue a state without that state's permission. Well, that's kind of an odd thing. What state's going to give you permission to sue it when it breaks contract with you or does something else against the law against you? It's not going to bother to allow you to sue it. So this, I believe, the 11th Amendment was a real violation of what the design of the federal judiciary was, to allow a citizen who's had their rights violated by a state of which they are not a citizen to have their day in court in a fair and just trial, and that, of course, would be before the federal court system. So in this understanding, those are the only cases where original jurisdiction is had by the federal government. A narrow range of cases involving foreign officials, states, and parties from various states or various countries. All other cases that the Supreme Court hears, and by the way, more than the majority, 80-90% of the cases that federal and state court, federal and Supreme Courts hear are in this other category that is not original jurisdiction. And we'll talk about that when we come back from the break.
Well, of course, I think it's so vitally important that people understand the essence of our Constitution. And I think the most important thing that you can learn from Article 3 is in Section 2, where the federal government has the right to limit the appellate's jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, and they could simply say to the Supreme Court, you will not say anything at all about abortion. We have limited your capacity to do that, or on so many of the other matters that they're getting involved in. Why doesn't Congress do that? Why? Because they're getting the Supreme Court to do what they want done. There is certainly a conspiracy against life. There are people who want to kill as many unborn children as possible. Go right ahead there.
Well, you just mentioned the second area of jurisdiction. It's appellate jurisdiction. That is, a case comes before a state court, and then it's appealed up through the state court system into the federal court system. And as you mentioned, Roe v. Wade is an example of this. It started in the state of Texas and went through the state court system, appealed up from the state court into the federal court and then up through the federal court all the way to the Supreme Court. All appellate jurisdictions can be restricted by Congress. As a matter of fact, Congress, if they wanted to, could make a series of laws that prevent the federal judiciary from ruling on any case except original jurisdiction cases. That is, admiralty and maritime law, cases between states or cases between nations and our states, all those sort of things. They could say, that's all the federal courts are going to do. They're going to do nothing else, because they're out of control, which they certainly are today. And Congress has only very rarely used this. And Tom Daschle used it for some tree-hugging sort of things in his state. But so they know what it is. It's not that they're ignorant of it. They know what it is, but to protect us against the violations of our government of life, liberty, and property, they are not doing it. We think of the Kelo case up in New London, Connecticut, where they're stealing people's property. But Congress could have passed a bill and said, on any case coming from any state dealing with eminent domain, the federal court system cannot rule on these cases. It's out of their appellate jurisdiction. And so Congress could clearly and severely limit the court's jurisdiction. So again, when we hear about an out-of-control judiciary, Congress is to blame. Congress is to blame. But they're hiding behind what they know is that most Americans don't know the Constitution, and therefore they won't blame the congressman for the problem. They'll blame the Supreme Court, and obviously the congressman will escape from the political wrath of the people that should be rightly directed at him instead of just rightly directed at the Supreme Court. Well, in Section 2, it also speaks of the right to trial by jury, which is preserved for all federal crimes. That is, if you're charged with a crime federally, you have the right to a trial by jury, unless it's a case of impeachment, which of course is something that if you're a federal official facing impeachment, that's a different matter that Congress and the Senate would deal with. And the trial is to be in the state where the crime was allegedly committed. The jury is to be of common citizens. And what we need to remember is the concept of the jury in the day of our founders is a different idea of the jury from what we commonly hear about and think about today. The jury was designed actually to be, you could almost say, a fourth branch of government, to be a check upon the power of the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. And really designed to be a very important check upon the abuse of power by governments, judges, and prosecutors. Consider what Thomas Jefferson said in 1789 in a letter. He said, "I consider trial by jury as the only anchor ever yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution." How does a jury do that? It does that by judging the law. And you can read, and I'm going to give you, we don't have time to do it tonight, but I give you a whole lot of quotes from our founders that say exactly that. The duty of the jury is to judge the law as well as to judge the facts in the case.
And I think what you're really saying is that if the law is unjust, why the jury can nullify it, at least for that one case. And this is what's known as jury nullification. And this is the one thing that the attorneys and the judges don't want the people to know, don't want the juries to know, that they determine what is really just and not. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening. Of course, this is Pastor David Whitney at the Institute of the Constitution. And we've simply been talking about things like jury nullification. And the whole idea of jury nullification is that the jury can go ahead and do away with the law, at least as it applies to that one case. Could you develop that idea just a little bit more for our listeners, David?
Yes, if you think about the jury sort of as a fourth branch of government, you look at a law that's created by the legislative branch. You know, the House puts the law together and they pass it to the Senate, and the Senate agrees and they modify the language a little bit. But anyway, they've got a bill they agree on. They send it up to the president. So the legislative branch has already made a review of this piece of legislation, and they have determined by voting for it, this piece of legislation is constitutional, it's just, it's in complete harmony with the laws of nature and nature's God, which is the Bible, and it's in harmony with our Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land. Those are the two standards by which any piece of legislation must be judged. So then they pass it to the president. The president reads through it, looks at it, and says, okay, yeah, this is constitutional, and this is in harmony with the laws of nature. Nature's God. I will sign it. And we usually say he signs it into law. And then, of course, we recognize that the judiciary also has a role to play, that they may judge this law as unconstitutional in a particular case and say, you know, there's a problem here, and if that problem's recognized, it may require the legislative branch to go back and reexamine this law and create a better version of it or something that avoids the constitutional problems. But we recognize that the judiciary has a right of review. As a matter of fact, in the famous case Marbury v. Madison in 1803, Chief Justice John Marshall there interpreted the language to authorize judicial review. That is, the power of the court to strike down a statute in the particular case before them on the ground that the law was inconsistent with the Constitution and therefore its application in this case was invalid. So everybody understands that, oh yeah, the legislative has their part in making law, the executive has their part, the judiciary has their part in judging the law, but the final application of the law is not to take place unless a jury looks at that law and says, yes, that law is in harmony with the laws of nature and nature's God, God's law, laws of nature, nature's God. And then it is also a law that is constitutional, that it is in complete harmony with the supreme law of the land. In other words, you may find that, you know, congressmen and senators have made an error. The president has made an error, and the Supreme Court and all the federal courts have made an error. But you as a juror, a one lone juror, can stand against the entire tyrannical government and oppose them with your vote that says this person is not guilty, not because the facts of the case say one thing or another, but because the law itself is not constitutional or it is not in harmony with the laws of nature and nature's God. For example, if someone were sitting on a case where someone's being charged under the Patriot Act, a grossly unconstitutional piece of legislation that Congress passed without reading it, and the Senate passed without reading it, which should have mean that all of those guys who voted for that should have been removed from office for failing to do their duty to look at a piece of legislation they were signing, then the president should be impeached for signing a piece of unconstitutional drivel, and the Supreme Court that's passed it and said, oh yeah, sure, that's constitutional. Again, all those branches of government have failed, but one patriot, one person who knows the Constitution in a federal jury can stand up and say, I'm sorry, all of you other jurors, I am not going to agree with you, and here's why. And perhaps, if they know their Constitution well enough, and they know their history, and know the right that the jury has to nullify, they may persuade the other 11 jurors, instead of saying guilty, say innocent, and the person once acquitted then can never be tried again for that same set of charges. So we, the people, hold this final power. And you're absolutely right, Dr. Stan. The judges don't want the jury to ever know that. And actually, the judges threaten the lawyers who would tell the jury that they have the right to nullify the law. They threaten them with disbarment, or they threaten them with contempt of court, and maybe even jail time. And so most lawyers are not brave enough to face that. And so most lawyers will never tell the jury that they have the right to judge the law as well as the facts. And yet that's exactly the role the jury was to play. And that is why our founders in Article 3 here, Section 2, when they talk about the right to a trial by jury, they're talking about this right where the jury is going to judge the law as well as the facts to protect the citizen from an unconstitutional, tyrannical government oppression.
I think it's so vitally important that people understand what our rights are as citizens. You see, there is a move towards a dictatorship in America. There really are people who feel that the Constitution gets away in the way. There really are people who would like to first remove basically our constitutional guarantees to merge the United States with Mexico and, of course, with Canada. This is what's known as the Security and Prosperity Partnership, SPP.gov. You can go to their website. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney, and we're talking really about the Institute of the Constitution. We're talking about the fact that they do not teach the Constitution in school today. They do not teach the Constitution in college and universities. They don't teach the Constitution in law school. Most of our politicians really don't understand the Constitution, and certainly many of our judges don't understand the Constitution. They honestly believe that the judge determines what the way things should be, and yet, of course, they are not to interpret anything other than the original meaning of the Constitution. Otherwise, if they could do whatever they want to, then we have rule by man rather than rule by law, and that is what fascism is all about, and that's exactly what we have in the United States today. When we have a group of men who've been put on the Supreme Court to take away our godly heritage, to take God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our society and do away with Christmas celebrations and do away with Easter celebrations, they know exactly what they're doing. And where is the outcry from our Christian leaders? Go ahead, Pastor Whitney.
Well, just to wrap up the little discussion there, the sidebar on jury and jury nullification, let me just quote our second president, John Adams. So here's somebody who knows our Constitution, was part of the founders in signing it and so on. He said, it's not only the juror's right, but his duty to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the directions of the court. There he stated boldly that if you ever serve as a juror, at the end of your process, before you go to deliberations, the judge is going to give you very strict instructions. And part of those instructions is usually include this. You are to judge the facts. I judge the law. I'll tell you what the law is. You just apply the law, look at the facts. And you know what? If that's all the jury does, well, a computer could do that. You don't need human beings. You know, weigh the evidence, make a decision based on the evidence, and ignore any judging of the law. But that's what most judges will tell jurors they are to do. We need an uprising of jurors who refuse to do that as a way of defending honest, upright, patriot people who are being abused by an oppressive and tyrannical government. Well, that's closing out the Section 2 of Article 3. Section 3 of Article 3 deals with the issue of treason. Very important that we understand what treason is, because today, in this War on Terrorism Day, we have a situation in which treason is being redefined and redefined back to what it was in England prior to our war for independence.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, David Whitney. David, before we go on, I really would like you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the Institute and the Constitution, how they can actually set up one of your programs in their own home, how they can begin to teach others, because this is really what we're going to have to do. Since our educational system has failed and since our judicial system has failed, we as citizens, if we care about our freedom, are going to have to learn about the Constitution, are going to have to teach others about the Constitution, and when the majority of people in this country understand what is going on, perhaps, just perhaps, why we can take our freedom back. So how can people actually get in touch with you? And if they do get in touch with you, what will they actually get?
Well, you know, most people, when you talk to them about the idea of teaching the Constitution, they get a little bit of a panic. It's like, oh my goodness, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a historian. I'm not a professor. I can't teach people the Constitution. Well, you don't have to. We put together what we call a host kit, and you host lecturer Dr. John Eidsmo, who's a constitutional law professor who talks about the Christian history and foundation underlying the philosophy of government that our founders established. Then he gives you a working knowledge of the founding documents, of the Declaration of Independence, essential to understand the tenets and the philosophy of government expressed in that Declaration of Independence, and then walks through the Constitution, all seven articles in detail, and then the Bill of Rights, and then the subsequent amendments, and also what's happened to America since the day of our founders, that we've drifted from what our founders designed, and we are now under a tyrannical system. And then he closes out the series of 12 lectures with the path back, one element of which, and a very important element, is what all of your listeners can play, and that is hosting an institute on the Constitution in your home, especially in your church. Every Bible-believing church should be doing this, training the people in their church, their congregation, training their congregation how to be Christian citizens. You cannot be a Christian citizen in America if you do not know or have a working knowledge of the Declaration, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. You can't do your job to hold your elected officials accountable. You can't even do your job to choose an official to vote for who would be one who will uphold the rule of law, will uphold the original intent of the Constitution. So we put together a host kit that's very turnkey, specific instructions for the host, discussion questions we've given answers to, and the test questions answers to in the host manual. All of it's together in a package, what we call the host kit. And you can purchase it by going to our web store if you want to go that route. It's our website is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. And our web store there has it available. You could also call us if you choose. Our toll-free number to call and order your host kit is 866-730-9796. 866-730-9796. You know, Dr. Stan, as I graduate various classes around the country, and we've had a very strong spring with great number of classes graduating, and I've visited a number of them to be able to encourage them. I always tell the people, now that you've gotten this education through this course, you are better qualified to serve in elected office in Washington, D.C., or in your state capital than 90%+ of the people who are currently in seat of power. Because they either don't know what the Constitution says, or they are choosing to violate the Constitution on a daily basis. And as a result of proclaiming that message to so many people, I've been challenged myself. And so I am actually running for office here in Maryland, state office, the House of Delegates, for a seat that needs to be taken from a tyrant who is currently the Speaker of the House, who's from my district. And so I'm applying what I'm teaching other people, that although I'm not a lawyer, although I don't have any political experience, never run for office before, nonetheless, I know that from the knowledge I have in studying the Constitution, I'm better qualified than the Speaker of the House in the state of Maryland, who is a lawbreaker, continually violating not only the federal, but especially the Maryland state Constitution. So we encourage you people to get a host kit, train yourself, your family, your church, and your community, and we can raise up an army of people to put the tyrants out of power and put true law-abiding citizens who will secure and protect our God-given rights into office across our land.
Now, David, one more time, your telephone number.
Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796.
And I think really what's sort of exciting is that a growing number of people all across the country are getting the kits, are putting on the programs, and then, of course, people are graduating, and more people are learning, and people who learn then will actually put on the programs themselves. So this is something that we've been at, how many years? Three or four years now?
Oh, no, it's been 6 years.
It's been 6 years. Well, I've been with you
growing.
Since almost the very beginning, and it's growing, and but you have to participate, and you've got to get others to participate. Do you really care about your freedom? What makes America different than other nations? Is it our Purple Mountains majesty, or our fields of waving grain? Or is it our Constitution, which was based upon God's law, and this belief that men cannot be trusted with power? So you have to limit the power of federal government for men to be free. For liberty and limited government are synonymous, and tyranny and total government are synonymous. And you can see today, as the administration refuses to close our southern borders to keep the terrorists out of our country, and yet, of course, they're going to take away our freedom because of the threat of terrorism, there's something seriously wrong with everything going on in America today. So with that as a background, David, please go ahead and pick up the rest of the story.
So Article 3, Section 3 deals with treason, and it's important to understand this because exactly what you're talking about, people are being labeled terrorists if they oppose the New World Order. That's basically where the definition is shifting today. The definition of treason in our Constitution shall consist only in levying war against them, that is, these United States, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. You need to remember, one of the things our founders had experienced from their tyrannical oppression in England is that in England, one could be convicted of having treasonous thoughts. In America, Puritans taught continually that conscience was beyond government's jurisdiction. treasons had to include acts, not just thoughts. And by the way, this also applies to all the hate crime legislation, which basically aims at judging a person based upon their thoughts, not solely upon their actions, and saying, well, if this person had a racial motivation for the murder, then he should receive a far worse penalty than someone who was not motivated by race, but maybe he was just motivated by robbery. Like, this is ridiculous. A person was murdered, the penalty should be the same. We should not go into this slippery slope area of saying we're going to determine what a person's motives were and their thinking was and judge them based on that. It's interesting here also that the reference is to these United States. It's a plural reference. And before the time of the War for Independence and then following subsequent, people referred to these United States, and they really referred to their own state as their nation, their land. For example, I think of General Lee, who he was asked by Lincoln to lead the army, the Union Army. He refused because he said he could not go to war against his own country, which is Virginia. That was his land. And so it was a compact of sovereign states coming together, united as these United States, not a nation in the sense of one conglomerated group that was each state was a mere subdivision of the federal government, which is basically what they are today. Instead, it was these individual states themselves have a great deal of power, and the federal government had very limited power in that day.
And boy, how that has changed now. And of course, that is because there are people who want to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., because it's much easier to control one center of power than 50 centers of power. It costs a lot more to bribe politicians in 50 states than just those in the United States Senate and in the Congress of the United States. And when you understand there really are those who want power, and of course they will simply, bribe politicians, they'll give them large sums of money, they'll surround them with people who will do their bidding, and unfortunately we're moving further and further away from this concept of individual freedom under God to being totally dependent upon the federal government for our health and for our welfare and for our liberty. Well, we're getting less and less liberty, and people have forgotten that you cannot trust government. Any government that can provide whatever you need must be able to take whatever you have. For government has nothing other than what it takes from us, and a government that can provide for you from the cradle to the grave must be able to control you from the cradle to the grave. So pick this story up, David.
So also in that Section 3 of Article 3, in addition to treason, it speaks about the evidence needed for a conviction. And it's interesting that it states two witnesses must be provided for there to be a conviction. And this actually is a biblical standard. You see, the founders just didn't come up with this idea out of their own brains. They were relying on the laws of nature and nature's God. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 6 says that whoever is worthy of death, that is, if a crime has been committed, a person is worthy to be put to death for this crime, a capital crime, whoever is worthy of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. But he shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. When people tell you that the Constitution has nothing to do with Christianity, they're lying. Here's evidence, as there's much other evidence in many other parts of the Constitution, but here's evidence that they were taking their clues in structuring our Constitution directly from the Bible. They were using the biblical standard because that's the supreme law of the universe. They were making the Constitution as close as they could in accordance with the supreme law of the universe, God's law. Another aspect of that is also right there in Article 3, Section 3. It says that Congress fixes penalty for treason by statute. That is, it's a law, it's not part of the Constitution what the penalty for treason will be. But it said that the penalty cannot include corruption of blood. That's a phrase that's not too familiar with most of us. What in the world is corruption of blood? And that means that the person's family is not to be put to death. Say the penalty is death. The person's family is not to be put to death for the crime committed by, say, their father or something to that degree. So citizenship rights or inheritance rights of one's family are not to be affected by the conviction of treason. Where did they get this idea? Again, directly from God's law, the supreme law of the universe. Let me read to you from Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 16 that says, "The fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin." Very clearly, God's word says that this idea of corruption of blood, that is, that the family is punished for the crime of the father, was prohibited by our Constitution. And that, again, was drawn clearly from God's word, the Bible, in preventing that corruption of blood, which, you know, it was often practiced in many, many other countries around the world. When we look at the limits, and we need to remember this, that the Constitution is a document designed to say this is what the federal government can do, this is what the federal government cannot do. These are the limits, these are the boundaries, and this is the wall, in a sense, placed around the federal government. And that wall can only be secure if there's watchmen on the wall who are very vigilant to see that the federal government stays within the boundaries of the Constitution. And that's where, in our day, and really for the past 50 to 100 years, the watchmen have been asleep, or perhaps they've not even been on the wall at all, or many watchmen in our day, which is the average citizen, aren't even aware that there's supposed to be a wall around the federal government, walling it in, saying it can do the things inside this wall, it cannot do anything outside this wall. The result is, many Americans figure, well, you know, the federal government can do just whatever it pleases, because whatever it says is law, that is the law. That's a very, very dangerous idea indeed. And it's an idea that people around the world would laugh at, because they've experienced tyranny firsthand, and they know that if you do not have restrictions on government power, the government will expand it to the point where you have no freedom left, and you are the slave of that government. But because in America, we have, for a century and a half, been following the Constitution, and so people have gotten used to liberty, and people have gotten used to the idea that's false, that, you know, your liberty is on autopilot, you know. You really don't have to do anything about it. It'll always be there. Of course, it's always there. We've got the Constitution, and it's a self-enforcing document. No, it is not. It's not a self-enforcing document. It takes we, the people, the citizens, who have made this compact, this covenant with our civil government. It takes we, the people, to enforce it. We got to be on the wall that the Constitution's created. We got to know what the wall is, understand the Constitution. We've got to be vigilant as watchmen on the wall to see that our federal government stays within the boundaries of the Constitution, and ready to blow the whistle and call the rest of the nation attention and action when the federal government gets outside the wall. But Dr. Stan, today things are so bad that the wall has been destroyed by our federal government, so now they have just kind of free range, you know. So the president says, well, we're going to issue an executive order, and, you know, whatever the words of the Constitution say, they don't matter a bit. Who cares about that piece of paper? We'll pass the Patriot Act, and nobody will even know the difference. And the sad truth is, most Americans don't know the difference. But we are seeking to educate millions of Americans so that we can raise an army of people to go and corral that federal government and force it back inside the walls that the Constitution created, because that's the only safe form of government. A government that's limited, restricted by its enumerated powers that we, the people, have given to it. See, if we understood that we are the creators of our federal government, then we would understand the purpose of our federal government is to serve us, to serve we, the people, not with welfare checks, no. It's to serve us by securing our God-given rights. That's the sole purpose of the government, as the Declaration clearly states. And if we recognize that we're not safe if that government ever steps outside that walled-in boundary that the Constitution creates, then we will be vigilant to protect our liberties by always guarding against every encroachment against that wall, because we'll recognize that the encroachment is as much an attack upon us as if a foreign invader, say, oh, I don't know, China, began invading the West Coast. And we say, oh, this is terrible.
The thing is, if we don't know the Constitution, then little bit by little bit, all power is drawn to Washington, D.C. And if that occurs, why, we will have a government as venal as the one from which we just recently were separated, Those are the words of Thomas Jefferson, talking about the Supreme Court, for he saw within our federal judiciary the seeds of the destruction of our nation. And Thomas Jefferson was a pretty smart guy. And I think that we need to heed his warning, because you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely everyone. There are people in Washington, D.C. who want a dictatorship, and some of them are leaders of both the Republican and the Democrat Party. Well, David, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay. Actually, I think we'll step a little bit into Article 4, which deals with the relations among the states. So if you want a quick outline of the Constitution, it runs this way. Article 1 is the legislative branch. Article 2, the executive branch. Article 3 deals with the judicial branch, which we've just covered. Article 4 talks about the relations among the states. How are the states to relate to one another? Article 5 deals with how this Constitution can be amended or changed. Article 6, a number of general matters, but most important in Article 6 is the Supremacy Clause that says this Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And then Article 7 deals with how that Constitution, or this Constitution, was to be ratified. So there's a very quick outline of the Constitution as a whole. Let's talk about the relations among the states just for a minute or two here. That the first section of Article 4 talks about what's usually said is the full faith and credit clause, that with few exceptions, each state must recognize as valid and give judicial enforcement to the legal enactments of another state, give full faith and credit to other states' laws. So if a divorce took place in Nevada or a marriage took place in California, it must be recognized as valid by, say, the state of Maryland. And that is generally the case. Now, where we get into the very difficult issue on that issue of marriage is what happens when a state, like Massachusetts, says two sodomites can get married. And those two sodomites get married, and then they move to whatever. Let's say they move to the state of Maryland, and they say, we demand the same rights of marriage as we had in Massachusetts. Well, you would think on faith, the full faith and credit clause here of the Constitution would require Maryland to recognize that, whatever you want to call it, sodomite relationship as a marriage. Yet, if the state of Maryland had a legal enactment that said their definition of marriage was only between one man and one woman, they could say it's against the public policy, the clear stated and clear law of this state, so that we do not have to grant the full faith and credit of something that violates clearly the statute law of our state. So that's one of the areas today that is a growing problem across our country.
Now, David, I think we're just about out of time, but really I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we'll pick this up next month when you're back with us again. One more time, get out your telephone number.
Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796, and our website is iotconline.com.
Well, God bless you. Thanks so much,
David.
We'll look forward to talking to you again next month right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and let me just once again encourage you to learn about our country. We carry some wonderful books. We carry America's God and Country by William Federer. We have The Faith of Our Founding Fathers by Tim LaHaye. We have Original Intent by David Barton. We have The Wall of Separation. We have so many books. I think one of my favorite is Betrayed by the Bench by John Stormer. The Supremacist by Phyllis Lafley, going into the Supreme Court. You need to understand the background of our way of life. And, of course, you would need to understand how there are people within the court system who hate America and will do everything they can to destroy it. Now, if you really want to put it all together into the spiritual implications, well, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. And, of course, you can get that simply by itself, or you can get it with a DVD or with a VHS, or simply get the tape and the VHS or DVD and the book and the Brotherhood of Darkness special. We want you to get the information. We want you to disseminate the information. We want you to help us inform the American people about what's really going on today, because freedom once lost will never be regained. So, again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Bill Federer's book, America's God and Country, over 800 pages, and you can get it on DVD or CD, or you can get it the book, or you can get them both together. But a great source of information, quotations from so many of the founding fathers about their Christian belief. Most of our founding fathers, with the exception of Jefferson and certainly Benjamin Franklin, most of them were evangelical Christians. There were a couple of Catholics that signed the Constitution, but this was primarily a Protestant nation, and it was based upon this dream that men could create a nation where men could be free and answerable not to government, but to God. And, of course, we also have The Faith of Our Founding Fathers by Tim LaHaye. We have the book Original Intent by David Barton. If you get those books and read them through, you'll know more than most members of the Supreme Court do today. And then, of course, don't forget John Stormer's wonderful book, Betrayed by the Bench, Phyllis Schlafly's book, The Supremacist, and those are both on the Supreme Court. And then we have a book entitled The Wall of Separation, going into the so-called Wall of Separation between Church and State, which was actually created. That wall of separation between church and state comes from the Soviet Constitution, not from the American Constitution. But we have people on our Supreme Court who would have our way of life and our form of government parallel that of the Soviet Union. And that's why, since the very inception of communism, it has been funded from right here in the United States. Did you ever wonder why it was that Bill Clinton and Janet Reno sent a 125-man heavily armed SWAT team to Miami, Florida, to kidnap Elian Gonzalez, to send him back to Cuba, to build up Fidel Castro's prestige? If you have not yet seen my video entitled World Revolution, my interview with Ambassador Earl Smith, who was the American ambassador to Cuba at the time that the United States intentionally brought the wicked Fidel Castro to power. You need to get that video. You need to watch it and watch it over again and help us to get the truth out. And remember, this is all a spiritual battle. Nothing as it appears to be. Pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. of Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So, if you, would like to give us a call, why, please hold your calls until we have, until we ask for them. Right now we have with us Rodney Stitz from DefraudingAmerica.com. That's www.defraudingamerica.com. We actually carry three of Rodney's books, Defrauding America, Drugging America, and of course, Unfriendly Skies. But he has a great deal more information, and you'll find Rodney a fascinating individual. And I'm going to let him tell you just a little bit about himself and how it was that he managed to so infuriate the courts of our country that they had him thrown into prison, not for committing a crime, but for trying to report to the courts that he had witnessed a crime, because he was one of the chief, if not the chief, accident investigator for the Federal Aviation Administration. Rodney Stitz, thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, good evening, Stan.
Go ahead. Why don't you tell our listeners who do not know who you are a little bit about your background and how it was that you ended up in the pokey?
Well, okay, I'll give you a few highlights here. Well, first, I started out as a Navy pilot in World War II, and then I was an airline captain for many years thereafter, and that included flying in Iraq and Iran. Matter of fact, I was in Iran the morning that there was a revolution. The revolution brought about by the CIA. And then I went with the Federal Aviation Administration as an air safety investigator. And eventually I was given the assignment to correct, at that time, I was at that time the world's worst series of air disasters. And it was when I got into that area that I started finding out the politics of air safety and the many crashes that were due to the politics of air safety. And when you have crashes occurring every few months, in those days they were every few months, not like today, but and then you have people cremated alive, dismembered alive in your immediate area of responsibility, you feel a little, you feel like you have to fight the system to do something. And this is what I did. Matter of fact, I even had to act as an independent prosecutor for about 5 months. And finally, since cover-up is so embedded into our culture, I finally figured, well, I'm not going to work under these conditions, so I left the FAA. But I continued to pursue, try to expose these the things that I discovered. Crashes were continuing. And everywhere I went, I ran into a block. Justice Department, the Congress. So finally, I decided, well, I'll write a book. So I wrote the first of many books called Defrauding America, and I started getting a correction. That was Unfriendly Skies.
Well, hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a minute. Our guest this evening is Rodney Stitz. And, of course, we're talking about his books. Well, there are lots of them. We'll be talking about all of them tonight. Well, Rodney, go ahead, pick up the story.
Okay, you ready?
You go right ahead.
Oh, okay. I thought we had a break there. Okay, so I'm getting on radio shows quite a bit. I started getting on hundreds of radio and television shows.
And other government agents started coming to me. That's FBI, CIA, DEA. And I felt, well, I've got to do something about this. This is serious. So since there was a cover-up everywhere else, there's a particular federal statute. It's the Federal Crime Reporting Statute that clearly says anyone who knows of a federal crime must report it to a federal judge or other federal officers. And a federal judge then has to receive it as part of his administrative duties. So anyhow, I filed the first two actions were against the FAA and NTSB, and the Department of Justice then moved to block me from reporting these, and the federal judges then eventually dismissed the action. And I went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court justices knew about what I was doing from, and that was about the year, about 1978. When some years later, as I'm finding out more information, from my CIA contacts, and this is October Surprise, the drug smuggling, things like that, I filed another action. I was blocked again. This was filed at Sacramento, California. And some months later, I'm finding out still other information. What they did in that action, they issued the first of several orders permanently barring me for the remainder of my life from filing any papers in any of the federal courts. Well, that's very illegal and unconstitutional, but since everybody goes along with it, what can you do about it? But anyhow, when I found discovered still more information, and these are federal crimes that's affecting national security and other national interests. So I filed an action again. So I was then held with criminal contempt of court, that being based upon the fact that I'm barred for the remainder of my life from filing anything in federal court. So they denied me a jury trial, and so they sentenced me to 6 months in federal prison. I was 67 years old at the time, and I had just undergone multiple bypass surgery, for open heart surgery. But
hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Rodney Sitz, and Rodney is saying that he is being going to be sent to prison. And what was his crime? He tried to report to the federal government criminal activity, and there is a statute that requires him by law to report to a federal judge if he knows of a crime. So he tries to report it. He is given a writ of some sort, says he could never again file anything with the court. He files it with the court, so they send him to prison, deny him a jury trial. They're going to send him to prison for 6 months for doing what he is obligated by federal statutes to do. Because it's all a cover-up, ladies and gentlemen. This was the late 1970s, and so Rodney then is sent off to prison. He's 67 years old. He's just getting over heart surgery, and so you pick up the story.
Okay, so I ended up in the pokey there, and just before I went into the pokey, I filed an emergency petition with Federal Judge Anthony Kennedy. He was a federal judge in the Court of Appeals in San Francisco, and he received this brief from me after he was appointed to the Supreme Court, but before he left. So anyhow, he was aware of all of the criminal activities that I and a group of other former government agents were trying to report. He was aware of the obstruction of justice by federal judges. He was aware of the retaliation. And so he turned me down. So this is interesting now, because here we have a key Supreme Court justice that got involved in extremely serious cover-ups and obstruction of justice. Now, it's interesting, the same justice, Anthony Kennedy, wrote a decision on May 30th of this year, which is just a few weeks ago, we're holding, and this is now the law, holding that any government agent who makes a report that displeases their supervisors can suffer retaliation, and that agent has no recourse. Now picture an FBI agent or a CIA agent reporting, let's say, terrorist activities that the supervisors don't want to hear about, or let's say all of the problems that I reported that were associated with some very brutal air disasters. They can retaliate against us now. So who's here? I mean, the fellow wasn't even whistleblowing. He was simply reporting. This was a district attorney, assistant district attorney, who was making a report. And in the report, he described how a sheriff deputy falsified an affidavit to obtain a search warrant. Well, the supervisor didn't want to hear this. Well, he had already made out the report, and so he suffered retaliation.
Well, I think it's very interesting that that President Reagan, actually, when he was governor Reagan appointed Justice Kennedy to the state Supreme Court, and there he went to the federal Supreme Court, and Ronald Reagan put him onto the Supreme Court. In other words, here was a man who was totally corrupt. Ronald Reagan knew him very well, put him on the state Supreme Court. Got him appointed to the federal court, then got him appointed to the, to the Supreme Court of our land, and he's still there today. Why would a conservative president put a radical like Kennedy, Justice Kennedy, onto the United States Supreme Court? And nobody likes to ask that question. So go ahead with the story there, Rodney.
Now, again, why? That I don't understand. But the facts are. So over a period of years, now I'm not only filing petitions, you might call an appeal, with the U.S. Supreme Court, but I also wrote them letters explaining what was going on. So they had a responsibility for the lower court judges, and here they knew about all of these things going on. Now, what I'm saying is not just academic. Among the consequences, let's say if we just look at the aviation area, and it covers many areas other than aviation because this involves drug smuggling and a lot more, but just in the aviation area, here I'm exposing the culture of arrogance and corruption in the FAA and then the cover-up by the NTSB political board members. And by covering up for this, there's all types of ripple effects. And one ripple effect occurred on September 11th. And people don't seem to realize this, that the primary area of blame for the conditions that enabled four groups of terrorists to hijack four airliners was in the government's aviation safety offices, and that area has been totally covered up, and all the government has focused on was the FBI and the CIA. But if they had focused on the FAA and all of this, and I left a long record of government records, especially in the courts, describing this, and if they went into that, then we would really be opening cans of worms. So we have a very, very serious problem there. But, you know, today we're so focused on Iraq and terrorism, the public forgets or never learned about the serious problems we have in the United States that has in the past cause more harm and is a greater threat to the American people than the terrorists. I'm not trying to minimize the terrorists, but we also have, if you and you could maybe call them terrorists, people in the government. For instance, we got the drug smuggling by the CIA. We had the drug smuggling by the Reagan-Bush years, especially during the Iran-Contra affair. You have the corruption in the bankruptcy courts, asset forfeiture. the way that innocent people are falsely charged and with perjured testimony, they end up in prison sometimes for life. And we have all types of problems in the United States. And this is what I try to do with my books now. I have over a dozen of them out now, and they focus on different areas. And there's no conspiracy theories. It's all facts that either I discovered or one of the, I probably have a couple of dozen of government insiders. I have former drug smugglers, a couple of former mafia figures, all feeding me data. So it's really, really very interesting.
All right, fine. And of course, certainly, a lot of the people you initially contacted when you were in prison, and these were honest people. These were people from the CIA and the FBI and the DEA. And why were they in prison? Because they were trying to get the truth out.
One of the first things they told me, and this surprised me because I was still naive in those days, is that there were a lot of CIA guys that were put in prison to silence them. And during the Reagan-Bush years, this was especially the CIA was really bad. They were involved in not only drug smuggling, but they were involved in looting the savings and loans. They were involved in all types of financial fraud transactions. They were involved in the bankruptcy courts. And this is what I learned over a period of many years from my CIA insiders. And so, this, again, as I said before, the public doesn't know about these things because the media and Congress has covered up for many years. And, of course, you've got members of the media who have been on the payroll of the CIA and other government offices for many years.
And I think it's really, maybe we could even talk a little bit about the Iran-Contra situation. The Iranians wanted to give our hostages back, contrary to what you've been told. But, of course, we didn't want them because we had actually seized all of the money. There were billions of dollars in our major banks over here. And, of course, it's a long story about how we precipitated the Iranian hostage. In fact, I've told this story before. I personally interviewed William H. Sullivan, who was the American ambassador to Iran, immediately before the hostages were taken. And they had actually sent in a group of students and seized his embassy there in Tehran and told him, you know, that they were going to leave. But if the United States brought the Shah of Iran to the United States, they would seize American embassy again. And when they did that, they would hold everybody hostage. So William H. Sullivan returns to the United States. He told me he told that to Zygmunt Brzezinski and to President Carter. And what did they do? They immediately invited the Shah to come to the United States for medical care that, of course, he could have gotten in Canada because they had to bring a Canadian doctor in to do the procedure. But that, of course, then precipitated the Iranians to carry out their threat to seize the American embassy in Tehran. And then, as soon as that happened, the American banks, that were holding these billions of dollars in Iranian money that the Shah had deposited here, they seized the Iranian money, and now, of course, we don't want the hostages back. Because we took the hostages back, we're going to have to go ahead and give the Iranians their money. So then, of course, the elections is coming up in November of the year 1980, and perhaps we get Rodney to tell us about the October surprise. Of course, everybody denies it took place. I personally, as I know Rodney has, talked to the pilot who flew the plane that took George Bush over to Paris to negotiate with the Iranians not to get the hostages released. But not to get the hostages released, not until Ronald Reagan was the President of the United States. And we'll be back in just a moment with Rodney to tell you more of this incredible story. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Rodney Stitz. Rodney, why don't you tell the story of the October surprise?
Yeah, so let me also mention I was in Iran the morning after the Shah came into power. I was flying Muslim pilgrims from Mecca and Medina. Those are the two holy cities during the Hajj.
Now, that would be 1953, then.
That's correct. And I was in a hotel there, and early in the morning, and nobody spoke English there, but there were only a few of us, maybe about six or seven of us crew members there, and we noticed a lot of commotion at the desk. Check-in counter, and the clerks were listening to the radio, and every now and then they would replace the picture that was on the wall behind them. First it was Mossadegh who was in control, then the Shah's picture would come go up, and then that changed a couple of times. But anyhow, we left there pretty fast at that time, because that's no place to be. An American one. Even in those days, they pretty much liked us, but it's still no place to be. Anyhow, as far as October Surprise, of course, that was the operation where you had William Casey and Reagan and Bush involved secretly. This is before the presidential election, where President Carter was still in office.
No, this is now the fall of 1980, and the election is coming up in November, and everybody's afraid that those crazy Iranians are going to release the hostages, which will make Jimmy Carter look good, and if he looks good, he'll get reelected. So they can't allow that to happen, because they want to get Ronald Reagan in. After all, George Bush wants to become certainly the vice president, but he's really, of course, the president. He runs the White House pretty well, and Ronald Reagan's more or less a figurehead. But they're not going to take a chance on Jimmy Carter getting reelected. So what happened?
Well, as you say, to be on the safe side, they didn't want the Iranians releasing the hostages. So there were secret negotiations held. And I learned about these secret negotiations from Gunter Reisbacher, who was a CIA asset. And he was in attendance at almost all of the meetings. One was held in the PepsiCo building in, I think it was Barcelona, and a number of other places. And he was telling me about how money was secretly paid to some Iranians, and also military weapons were smuggled out of National Guard armories and flown to Iran, and also Iran was promised large quantities of military weapons if they would delay the release of the hostages till after the election. And of course that occurred. And in the book, I describe how George Bush was flown to Paris for a secret meeting and how that came about. And that's described in my book called Defrauding America. And then I ran into a couple other people. One, Oswald LeWinter, and his role was cleaning up the records in Paris to see that there's no evidence of any of the Americans being there during that one most important meeting.
And of course, they cannot let the American people know that our leaders were negotiating to keep the hostages hostage. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Rodney Stitch, and he was just telling us about the October surprise, when American officials were actually negotiating with the Iranians, promising to give them weapons if they would keep the hostages until after Ronald Reagan was elected. And that's what it was all about. And of course, Gunther mentions it had met, pardon me, Rodney mentions it met Gunther Reisbacher, who I have actually met and interviewed. And then, of course, he met another gentleman who was in Paris. His job was to clean up all the evidence so nobody would ever find out what had really happened when, of course, George Bush was flown in one of the Blackbirds, these supersonic planes, to Paris and back again without anybody even realizing that he'd gone. Sort of like President Bush went over to Iraq the other yesterday or the day before, a couple of days ago. Nobody even knew, of course, what had happened to him. Anyway, so the American people cannot understand the skullduggery and the betrayal of those hostages. And everybody had the yellow ribbons out, and we were all being manipulated. They were not trying to get them back. They were trying to keep them from being released. So go ahead, Rodney.
They held hearings on the October surprise, and then that was the typical cover-up, which is, having watched this for many, many years, that's about all we have, cover-ups. They may come out, just like the Iran-Contra affair. They didn't go into all of the drug smuggling that was going on, where Ali North and other White House personnel were involved. But and then the media covered up for it, just like they've been covering up for the drug smuggling for many, many years. So the public is really deceived constantly. So the public really doesn't know what is going on. I was the same way until I started being an activist in the government and discovering what went on. But it wasn't until I really met some of these people from the CIA and others where I really discovered just how bad the corruption is. And the young people today, they have no idea. And that's why it would be very useful to them to read some of these books, especially Defrauding America. And you can even download some of them for no charge, at least part of the book, at defraudingamerica.com.
And I think it's so interesting that they cannot let the American people know that the CIA was over in Vietnam dealing in drugs. And I know this to be true. I mean, I've heard this from many people who were there. And so many of the young men, the casualties, you know, who were sent home, you know, in coffins, they simply eviscerated them. They packed their abdomens with drugs, brought them in the United States, opened them up, took out the drugs, and sewed them back up again. And families never knew. Monica Jensen Stevenson wrote a wonderful book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. It was the story of course, the men we abandoned, but it also had to do with the CIA and drugs. And of course, I remember when that book was pulled off the bookshelves all across America. The publisher pulled back the copies because they did not want people to read the book. It became unobtainable. Monica went up to Canada, and where she got the book republished, somebody immediately bought the publisher and shredded 5,000 copies of the book. And we have two interviews with Monica Jensen Stevenson, one in my 4-tape set, The Men We Left Behind, and of course the second in the One Man Returned 4-tape set, and she will tell you the story I've just told you. That's how they suppress the information, withhold it here in America. They cannot let the American people understand that the major source of drugs in the world is the American CIA. Why is it that when America, you know, took over Afghanistan, there was very little drugs being grown there? The wicked Taliban had pretty well shut down the drug traffic. And as soon as the Americans took over Afghanistan, once again, the fields bloomed with poppies, and Afghanistan became the largest source of drugs anywhere in the world. Why, when we control that entire country, why was there so many drugs being grown? And oh, they give you all the excuses. Oh, my goodness, you know, what would the poor farmers do if we were to burn the fields? I mean, how would they make a living? And I would have everybody mad at us. We stopped growing the drugs over there. Ladies and gentlemen, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And the American people have failed to oppose what our government has done. Maybe you say, well, I didn't know about it. Well, if you didn't, you know now. And you have an obligation to find if we're really telling the truth. Rodney's books are excellent. And let me recommend Defrauding America. And he has another book called Drugging America. Both of them we carry. Both of them are must reading. And so we're going to be back here in just a moment. And, of course, we will actually take a few calls here as soon as we return right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Rodney Stitz, and we have Daryl calling from New York. Whereabouts in New York are you calling from, Daryl?
Hello, Johnstown, New York. It's about I'm up in the woods, so it's about 60 miles north and west of Albany.
All right, fine. Of course, you're then getting that the signal out of Albany, where we have a 50,000-watt station that carries us at this time of night. So it's getting pretty late back there. Did you have a question at all for us?
I have about 50,000 of those watts.
Okay.
I wanted to call you one night to tease you, but you never have a calm night. You know, you're always so darn busy.
Well,
I wanted to tease you about being a doctor, but let me, you know, I'm a two-tour Vietnam combat veteran, and I have my rights as far as my military records being released. I can do it or I can't do it. And John O'Neill has never been, confronted as far as releasing his records. Senator Kerry refused to release his records as far as military records, but I feel that anyone that runs for any position as far as a high political position should release their records for us to see. Now, anyone listening to me right now say, this man's crazy. Who's going to put a bill like that forward? They're not going to release their records, but if I were a politician and I had a military background, and I was running against someone, I would say, I have released my records for my constituents to review. Where are yours?
Okay, fine. Well, Daryl, thanks very much. Did you have a question for our guest?
No, that was my opinion. I just wanted to see what kind of an opinion he had towards my situation.
Do you have any thoughts on that at all, Rodney?
I don't believe so. That's
all right, fine.
My,
thanks so much, Daryl. And I certainly think that if you have nothing to hide, why not release your military records? If you do have something to hide, why, you certainly wouldn't. And it's very interesting that George Bush has never released his records. Thanks. Nor has John Kerry. Thank you. And I think that we've got some real problems with some of the people we have in political office today. And there's so much is secrecy. And, you know, how can you have a free society when you have secrecy in government where they're keeping everything back in the name of national security? And even more frightening, how can you have a free society when you have voting machines that give false results? In fact, you remember that one voting machine in Ohio that had 800 people in the precinct and 4,000 votes for George Bush? But the explanation was, well, the machine had a hiccup. And if you believe that, you probably believe that George Bush won the election. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Rodney Stitz. And Rodney, before we go on, I want you to give out your telephone number and your website and tell people what they can get at your website.
Right. The website would be the three W's, of course, and defraudingamerica.com. And on that website, you'll get information on the books and a lot of information on judicial corruption, what have you. And there's also every one of the books you can download for only $12. Those are 500 to 700 page books. Or you can download a part of them, about a third of them, at no charge. So you can get quite a bit of information. A large number of former government agents have discovered, and some of whom have been murdered in the process of getting the information out. So it's an interesting site.
Now, do you have a telephone number for people to call?
Well, we have, care to order, we have a 1-800-247-FraudingAmerica.com.
Okay, and so you had an opportunity to meet a lot of the CIA agents and FBI agents and DEA agents when you were in federal prison. And then, of course, when you got out, why, people kept providing you with information, which is really the basis for your books, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Like, we have, right now there's something very interesting going on that's getting very little publicity, and this is the murder charges against a former supervisory agent in the New York office.
Now, that's the FBI office, isn't it?
Yes. And now the information that the Brooklyn BA used file those murder charges, and they were filed about a month ago. I had that same information from Gregory Scarpa Jr. He was a former mafia member in New York, and he and I had a book contract in 2002. So he's given me all this information about the how this FBI agent gave him and his father the name of government informants. His father would go out and murder him and things like that. And now this went on for years. And as a matter of fact, another FBI agent, Richard Tosh, worked on the DiBiccio. That's the FBI agent. And this FBI, this DiBiccio, would repeatedly block Tosh from his investigation. So when Tosh started complaining, you know what happened? Tosh ended up in prison, and DiBiccio, who's now charged with murders, got off scot-free. And another thing, in 2003, that's 3 years ago, I notified members of Congress. They were investigating the FBI agents involved in murders up in Boston. And I thought, well, this is great. I'll let them know I have a mafia source and two other sources that know about FBI agents murdering people in the New York office. And would you believe not a single one ever responded to me?
And there's a story about what happened in the Boston office. It really is amazing. There's a book, I think it's called Dangerous Deception, and it was written by a Boston Globe reporter. It was the story of the FBI actually covering for a man named Whitey Bulger. Whitey Bulger was a vicious criminal. He loved to torture people to death, and he killed and tortured to death about 20 people over a period of 20 years while he was working for the FBI, and while he was being protected by the FBI. And whenever, of course, the local authorities, not the FBI, but the local authorities were coming after Whitey Bulger, the FBI would always warn him, and actually when they were closing in on him, for multiple murders and torture deaths, the FBI warned him, and Whitey Bulger escaped. He's still one of the most wanted people in the country and the world today. And the incredible thing is, of course, that it wasn't just the local FBI agent. He was just doing his job. He was just doing what he was told to do. They went all the way up into the headquarters of the FBI and to J. Edgar Hoover himself, who knew about this operation and of course, justified and supported it. That's the incredible story of Whitey Bulger and the story you're telling about the Boston office. And the fact that the average individual never knows that simply reflects the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think.
That's it. You mention this to the average person, they won't believe you. But if this really goes on, and it does go on because it's been proven, this, of course, is a culture in the FBI, and this is one of the things that helped the terrorists carry out their plot, the 9/11 terrorists, with a culture like that. And then, of course, we know about the FBI supervisors that were blocking FBI agents from following up on their leads, which is the same thing that was going on in the FAA. This is standard. And as I said in letters 20 years ago to members of Congress, you cover up for it, and it's going to continue and get worse. And it does get worse.
Well, you actually wrote a book about 9/11. What is your take on what really happened that morning? Certainly, you had access to a lot of information. What do you think actually happened? Was it simply incompetence, or was there some skullduggery there?
Well, I wrote a book called 9/11, Blowback 9/11 and Cover-Up. And of course, I bring out the facts to show where the primary blame is for the conditions that enabled the terrorists to hijack four airliners, and that's what's being covered up. Then I go into how the culture in the FBI and the CIA, and I mention these things, how that is the secondary area of blame, why they weren't functioning as they should have. And then I go into all of the federal actions I filed. Like, for instance, shortly before 9/11, I filed a federal action in Reno, Nevada, trying to expose the corruption in the FAA and other places. and they blocked me there. Then after the 9/11, I filed a lawsuit in the New York District Court trying to expose these matters. And in the book, I go into everything that the federal judges did to block me from making these reports. So there's a lot of scandals in the books, and if people would only look at it and realize the significance of it.
So, Rodney, do you think that the government had advanced knowledge that there was going to be some sort of an attack on our buildings here? There was going to be hijackings, and they were going to use those planes as bombs?
Well, they had plenty of notices that this was going to be done. Whether they knew what day, I have no information to indicate that, but they had plenty of notices. And the CIA, if we had a competent administrator, and we haven't had a competent administrator in many years, we get it politically correct. Now you have that nice little Marion Blakely, and I mean, she's not qualified to. They had so many warnings of hijackings, and I recommended years ago when I was an FAA inspector how to prevent hijackings. And it was so simple. How did they get in the cockpit? They got a key. And where did they get the key? They get the key from the flight attendants. Nobody will address that. No, but they didn't have to break any doors down. They just got the key. And so I go into that, and then I go into, there's some screwy conspiracy theories out there, so I address those and try to show how ridiculous some of them are.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, you've got a number of books on a number of different subjects, and what is the latest book you've got out?
Well, the latest is the FBI, CIA, the Mob, and Treachery, and in that, it's the life of this FBI agent, Richard Toss. He was a lieutenant colonel. He was a highly decorated Vietnam pilot. He adopted a Vietnamese orphan. And he was with the FBI in New York working under DiVicio. And then I go into the treachery within the FBI, the cover-ups, the corruption there, and things like that. And poor old Richard Tosh, he's in prison at Dannemora in New York.
Have you talked to him, or don't people who have talked to him?
People can write to him, and the address is on my website, but you can even download part of his book.
Is this his book? Is this his story? Has he told it to you, or what?
Oh, he told it to me. He sent me hundreds and hundreds of pages of material. So at the beginning of it starts out with the battles he was in Vietnam, and the battles are quite exciting.
So what about as far as those relationships? Why did they send him to prison? What was his charge against him?
Well, what he was doing, he was exposing CIA operation that was part of Ali North's enterprise, and he was also exposing the White House secret funding of Iraq during the 1980s.
Now, what about, you mentioned this, something having to do with Ali North. What was Ali North involved in at that time?
Well, Ali North had the enterprise, and this one outfit believe it was Staten Island. I have to check my records again. But that was part of the Ali North enterprise. And anyhow, it involved the White House politicians and elections were coming up. So when his boss had told him to knock it off, he contacted members of Congress and then ran into the same thing I ran into. All they do is cover up. But then the FBI, they first, to get him out of the picture immediately, they charged him with misusing a gasoline credit card. He spent $9 refueling his personal car that was being used on government business that was routine. But that got him out of the picture, and then they were able to work on Brooklyn District Attorney, the new political appointee, and he was charged with having inappropriate contact with boys at a athletic club, which was a front that he set up for the FBI. So anyhow, then he was pretty well railroaded in trial there, so he ended up in prison. So he's a guy, Vietnam veteran, highly decorated, trying to blow the whistle. He also was reporting drug smuggling in Vietnam and to members of Congress, and that they, of course, as usual, covered up. So anybody who comes to the defense of the United States without any public support, you get wiped out. That's unfortunate.
How long is he going to be in prison?
Well, he has an 80-year prison sentence.
An 80-year prison term, supposedly for molesting boys.
That's
a pretty long time for a prison term. This obviously must be, you know, a contrived sentence. I mean, we have people here all the time, you know, who, you know, are certainly involved with molesting boys. They may get 10 or 20 years, but 80 years?
Yeah, well, old Riewald, he originally got 80 years for, he was the head of this CIA operation.
He was a CIA bank. That was actually a CIA bank that was laundering money for the CIA, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, in the book, now here's something where you can't get the public to respond to anything. Riewald, here he is. He had worldwide attention in the mid-'80s when the cover was blown. So anyhow, when he comes out of prison after 10 years, he turns over to me three or four boxes of CIA documents, and the Belli law firm turns over two more boxes. Well, I'm going through these, and I find in an envelope a personal record that Riewald made concerning CIA funding of secret bank accounts for six different politicians. Two of them were George Bush Sr., and the other was Armitage. And now, that's in the book, and not a single person has ever brought it to my attention. So it doesn't matter what you say, if it's not the ball game, they're not interested.
Well, I hope that our listeners out there who are listening across America are interested. And if you're out there and you have a question for Rodney Stitz, give us a call. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Rodney is a... How old are you now, 83 or so?
Yeah, I'm 83, but I'm still active.
I know you are. Yeah,
you know, I'm not going to be able to continue much longer, but I've been at this since the early 60s. Do you realize 45 years I wasted trying to bring this out? What a waste of time.
Well, I don't think it's a waste of time, Rodney. I think we've done a yeoman's job, and I think we're all indebted to you for getting the information and getting it to book form and getting it up on the Internet. And, you know, you've done your part. The question is, are there enough people out there who care, who are willing, of course, to pull down the information, to get the books, to read it, and then to pledge themselves to become involved in this battle? Because this is truly a battle for the survival of Christian civilization. And as we've said so many times, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And if you're not involved in this battle, then you're part of the problem. And one day, I personally believe we are all going to stand before the throne of judgment. And I wouldn't hate to say I was too busy to be involved. I didn't believe it, or I thought maybe it wasn't true, or I was afraid. And I think that is what motivates many people. Well, I believe that if you do what's right, God is going to be with you, and no matter what happens. So, Rodney, never think for a moment that you've wasted your life or wasted 45 years. You have done what was right, and one day you will get your reward.
Well, that's probably the only reason I can find a little satisfaction, is that it was the thing to do. But anybody faced with the same position, they've got to realize they're going to lose everything if they, because the public's not with that. Look at all the support we have now for the invasion of Iraq and killing all those people over there. When you've got that many people supporting that, we're in a declining culture, and I don't know if we'll ever change it.
Well, I don't know that we will either, Rodney, but I think that we have a moral obligation to try. I know you try, I try, and there are a handful of people out there who are, you know, have a voice as you and I do. But there are an awful lot of people who do support us, and we're indebted to them. So don't get discouraged. And that is not ours to determine what's going to happen. Our job is to do the best we can and wait and upon the Lord. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with Rodney Stitz. Let me recommend his books, Defrauding America, Drugging America, Unfriendly Skies, and, of course, go to his website, www.defraudingamerica.com. That's www.defraudingamerica.com. You need to be involved. Well, Rodney, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up this evening's program.
Okay. Well, you know, there's so many people that have been hurt, by the harm that is going full blast. Yeah, we have people in prison, some of them with a life sentence, who have been falsely prosecuted, where they get paid perjury to put them there. And there's so many other places where people have been harmed so seriously. Just 9/11. Just think, a little ripple. Just think, if the corruption did not exist in the FAA, they would have done their job. The terrorists would never have hijacked those aircraft. We wouldn't have an invasion of Iraq or all these other things today. So it's little ripples like what I and other insiders have tried to expose would have prevented all this. But you've got everywhere, you've got cover-ups. And this is why it's up to the public. Nobody, the checks and balances aren't working. They're very corrupted, and it's up to the American people. And there's only a few of those who will get off their behind. So it's up to those few to speak out, and let's get a little help here.
Well, I agree with you totally, Rodney, and I do what I do because I'm hoping that people will tell people who will tell people, and don't get discouraged if you tell people and they don't want to hear. We are moving very, very rapidly into a series of, I think, major crises. I do believe, of course, that the economy is on the verge of collapse. I believe that we are on the verge of another major war, and that war will bring, certainly nuclear attacks on America. The world, this wonderful utopian world we live in, will soon cease to exist. Perhaps at that time, people will begin to ask, and what's going on, that perhaps they'll remember what Rodney Stitz said, or what some of the things that they may have heard on this program. Our job is to do our best and to be the watchman on the wall, called for in Ezekiel 3 and Ezekiel 33. And, of course, after that, the battle is the Lord's. Rodney, thank you so very much for being with us. Don't get discouraged. We'll look forward to having you again with us real soon on one of our other programs.
Okay, Stan. Thank you.
Good night and God bless. And, of course, Rodney has been at this for a long, long time. And I think we should be indebted to him. You need to get his information. Believe me, I personally know some of the people that he writes about, other stories I'm well acquainted with. The major source of drug smuggling in the world is your own government. Do you care? Well, this is Archie Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family and helping us as we reach out 5 hours every day on the Internet and radio someplace, and 4 hours on shortwave and 9 hours on satellite, and you can't get any of the other sources. You can always get us off Telstar 5. We do hope many of you want to get our 4-tape set. Is There a War on Drugs? And it's actually 6 different segments on 4 tapes. Fascinating material. You'll actually hear one of the White House press conferences when Sarah McLennan asked Bill Clinton about what happened at Mead Airport and the smuggling there, and Bill Clinton says, oh, that wasn't me. That was a federal operation. That was a federal operation there at Mead Airport. In other words, the federal people were involved in drugs, but of course that was when he was governor of the state of Arkansas, but of course he didn't do anything about the federal involvement in drugs after he got to be the president. Oh, Cindy, you want to read Rodney's book, Drugging America. His book, Defrauding America. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you will listen there and, of course, get the information and help us to disseminate it across America. If you, of course, want to hear the story by Monica Jetson Stevenson about her experience, her effort to try to get people to understand that Vietnam was about drug smuggling in large part, and, of course, smuggling drugs back, and the bodies of American boys who'd been killed in Vietnam. Her book was, of course, Kiss the Boys Goodbye, long since out of print. But, of course, she tells the story in her first interview, which was The Men We Left Behind. It's a four-tape set. And then in the second interview, which is One Man Returned, the story of Bobby Garwood. She tells about how she moves to Canada. She gets her book republished up there by a Canadian publisher, and somebody accidentally shreds 5,000 copies of her book. And the thing is amazing is Monica thinks it was just an accident. Well, I don't. I mean, I've seen this technique used over and over and over again to keep the American people from learning the truth, because you have to understand, we're involved in dealing with a sinister group of men who have a different worldview. They march to a different drumbeat because they worship a different God, and they are fearful that the American people might wake up. They have a lot more confidence in the American people than so many of the people we deal with all the time. They must keep the information from the American people, and of course you really need to get our information. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. And give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty and help us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.